Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about events along the Pacific coast of South America during the first millennium BC and the first millennium AD. The development of political systems in this region through this time that really culminated in the rise of significant territorial states in the Andes and along the Pacific coast in the first millennium AD. And these are especially concentrated particularly on the state of Tiwanaku and Wari. Now, there are a variety of different things that we need to keep in mind when we're thinking about the development of states in this area of South America. But what I particularly want to note, and something that archaeologists concern themselves with particularly, is the evolving religious tradition, the ceremonial tradition, that seems to have been shared to a significant degree by Tiwanaku and by Wari, that would contribute to the Inca state, which is, of course is going to be the topic of this lecture, and that we can also perhaps trace back into the first millennium BC and potentially even beyond. This was not an identical, unchanging ritual tradition, but there seem to be common elements, important common elements, shared widely through this region, across space, and through time. The culmination of state developments in Pacific South America was the rise of the Inca Empire in the 15th century AD. Many of the political and social processes that led to the rise of the Inca see their origins in earlier states in this region, and especially in successful predecessor states like Tiwanaku, Wari, and Chimú. And these developments include the attention paid to agricultural developments and agricultural innovations, of which the irrigation systems around the Chimú capital at Chan Chan were probably the most impressive before Inca times. Thus, for example, the 70-kilometer, 40-mile-long irrigation canal that linked the Chicama and Moche River valleys, a very, very significant engineering feat. The extension and elaboration of the road systems that in earlier times had been used, as far as we know, exclusively for ritual purposes. Developments in the administrative systems that would ultimately allow the Inca to govern a large, multi-ethnic, multilingual empire, including regional administrative centers. And, as well, possibly the policies of population displacement that the Inca would use so effectively in governance of that empire. The Inca state originated in the 12th century AD in the area around Cuzco in southern Peru, northwest of Lake Titicaca. It's probably significant that the Inca state appeared in an area that had earlier been subject to both Tiwanaku and Wari cultural influences, and in an area with significant agricultural potential. The original Inca polity seems to have been a small state organized merely around the political center at Cuzco. Expansion really began in the 15th century AD under the Inca ruler Pachacuti and continued for the next century, for the most part interrupted only by the arrival of the Spaniards in AD 1532. At its height, in the late 15th century, the Inca Empire controlled a vast state running from southern Colombia in the north to southern Chile and western Argentina in the south, and stretching from the Pacific across the Andes toward the forests of the Amazon. As the name implies, and to a greater degree than any earlier state in the region, the Inca Empire using that term advisedly, grew by conquest. The incorporation of conquered lands into its territory, and through the large-scale transfers of defeated populations from one part of the empire to another. These transfers were undertaken in order to undermine social solidarity and territorial identification of conquered populations. So you can imagine the Inca coming into an area, and even after the armies and the government had been defeated, still finding some resistance from indigenous populations, perhaps not too keen to replace one set of overlords with another. So one important strategy of Inca governance involved large-scale population movements, taking those resisting populations and moving them someplace else, cutting off the ties between people and territory, and replacing those displaced populations in their former territories with communities more loyal to the Inca state. One frustrating aspect to the study of the Inca expansion is the extent to which research is dominated by historical accounts. The legacy of chronicles written by the Spanish after their conquests in the 16th century. Now, I don't want to complain about historical accounts, and I'm not going to complain about historical accounts, because they are very valuable as we seek to understand Inca society. But at the same time, they also have their dangers. They have their own perspectives. These historical accounts tend to portray the Inca expansion as largely due to the actions and initiative of individual Inca rulers, which is not an unusual perspective to take. Historical accounts in the Western world, in Europe and in North America, have often done the same thing. While the initiatives of individual rulers were no doubt important, these portrayals very much beg the question of how, in a relatively short period of time, a century or two, a small state, to be perfectly frank, a quite undistinguished state, could have transformed itself into the largest empire ever seen in pre-Columbian South America. As archaeologists, we're interested in the reason for this happening. And a simple answer that says that it's all due to a particular Inca ruler is not a very satisfactory answer from our point of view. In addition, such great man perspectives, as we might call them, do not yield reconstructions. They do not yield models that can easily be examined or tested archaeologically. If everything is due to the genius of a particular individual, what can we do with that? How do we test that? There are, however, a number of other factors, both intrinsic to Inca society and extrinsic, that may also help explain Inca success. First, the Inca expansion came at a time when neighboring and potentially competitive states like Chimú were entering periods of disorganization and relative decline. But as I've already noted, these states did provide, very usefully to the Inca, organizational and administrative models that the Inca could make use of in governments. They could take the useful things from these earlier states, but in circumstances where those earlier states were not so much in competition with the Inca. The Inca came from a region of high agricultural potential, which could support large populations, and also importantly in this region, always in Andean South America, very significant textile production, if farming techniques were intensified. So there's a great deal of potential to support large populations in the Inca heartland. The system of labor-based taxation known as mita, developed by the Chimú but elaborated and perfected by the Inca, allowed the mobilization of effort in order to exploit the potential of these kinds of rich agricultural territories also allowing Inca rulers to engage in important communal building activities, including work on urban architecture, on roads, on fortifications, and the other panoply of activities that are required to govern an empire. This mita system also tied commoner and subjected populations, conquered populations, to the state for a significant period of each year. So it was a taxation in labor. During certain times of the year, then, common people and conquered people are required to engage in communal activity. And during these periods, they were also fed and supported by the state while engaged in state labor. It's interesting to note that in some cases, this may have involved travel, some cases to quite distant areas along the road systems I've mentioned. As I noted in an earlier lecture, some archaeologists believe that the construction of the pyramids played a similar role of tying common people to the activities of the state, played a similar role in the development of the Egyptian state. The Inca made good use of religious innovations on their own part by emphasizing the divinity of the living ruler and the royal ancestors and promulgating the national cult of Viracocha, the sun god, while at the same time incorporating earlier ritual centers in conquered territories into their ritual system. And it's quite likely, actually, that this process reflects common practice in earlier states in Pacific South America as well, states like Wari or Moche, so that we can think of an evolving ideological system stretching back, perhaps in some form, with its ultimate origins in the 3rd millennium BC, but continuously revivified by innovations from competing religious and political centers. So the situation here was not the attempt to eliminate earlier religious forms, but to incorporate them into an evolving religious system. This might help explain the different aspects of ritual continuity in monumental architecture, for example, and innovation during the Chavín period, for example, that's found in this region. Thus, the Inca Empire as well certainly partook of the common elite civilization mentioned in the last lecture. One very unusual element in the Inca social-political system was the pattern of royal inheritance. The wealth accumulated by an Inca ruler was, on his death, vested in a corporate group of his descendants, who maintained a royal court after his death, who maintained a royal court and cult presided over by the preserved body of the dead king. So it's as if the deceased ruler had never actually died at all, but continued to live, continued to hold court. And so we have a sort of a multiplication through time of Inca royal courts. If the Spanish hadn't invaded, who knows how many there would have been ultimately, one for each of preceding dead rulers. Now this practice more or less deprived the new ruler, the successor, usually one of the dead king's sons, deprived that ruler of the wealth that he in turn would need to support his own court, because the wealth accumulated because of the actions of the dead ruler is now taken up in supporting the court of the dead ruler, not the living one. So this new Inca, this new ruler, has to find the resources necessary to support his own court, both during his life and, important to remember, after his death. This wasn't a matter, I will note, of mere pageantry. Generous gifts to nobles and supporters were necessary in order to secure their backing and thus to protect the ruler against overthrow. The accepted way to accumulate such wealth was to conquer new territories for the empire, so that the resources could be used to support the living head of state. This obviously led to a dynamic of constant state expansion. And it's interesting to speculate how this system of inheritance would have developed had the Spaniards not intervened, because at some point, state expansion would presumably have had to come to an end. One does not really understand what would have happened to the political system in that case. So, in total then, the rapid expansion of the Inca state, the Inca Empire, is probably due in large part to a combination of these political and cultural and religious factors. And not merely, certainly in part, yes, but not merely or exclusively because of the genius and initiative of particular Inca rulers. Another aspect of kingly succession occasionally caused conflicts and might well have increased in importance had the empire continued to expand. The new ruler was not necessarily the oldest son of the deceased king, but was theoretically chosen for his competence from what was often a large number of brothers and half-brothers. While such a choice is admirable in a sense, it did make war between the various claimants to the throne much more likely. And such a civil war actually did happen just before the arrival of the Spanish and certainly contributed, at least in part, to the downfall of the Inca Empire. It often seems as if archaeologists use the Inca as a prime example of what one might call a competent ancient state, in large part because it was not so ancient. Obviously, we have European accounts on its functioning, which in many ways does seem to have been very efficient. At the same time, we have to remember that the Inca were the inheritors of a 4,500-year-old tradition of increasing socio-political scale and complexity in South America. The population of the Inca capital, Cuzco, was probably about 100,000 people in the early 16th century AD, making this by far the largest urban settlement in South America until that time. Perhaps the most striking aspect of Inca urban planning at Cuzco was the extent to which the city was thought of as a representation of the empire as a whole. Or perhaps, given the rapid Inca expansion over a century or so, we could say that the empire was a representation of the city. Different quarters of the city represented different provinces of the empire, and leaders from the conquered territories had to reside in the appropriate quarters of Cuzco for at least part of the year. This use of the capital, or sometimes even the ruler's house or palace, as a conceptual model of the state as a whole, is a common characteristic in many historically and ethnographically known societies. In fact, it works the same way in some of the societies where I work in northern Cameroon. The architectural styles used in the monumental architecture found at Cuzco, at the royal estate of Machu Picchu, and on other Inca sites, that is, those sites originally Inca and not appropriated from common people, this monumental architecture does not seem to have been borrowed from earlier states like Tiwanaku or Wari. It's a form, if you like, one of the terms that's sometimes used is it's a Cyclopean architecture. It's so named after similar approaches to architectural construction in stone from Mycenae in the eastern Mediterranean. And this Cyclopean architecture consisted of large stone blocks carefully fitted together without masonry and is one of the most recognizable, one of the most characteristic features of Inca sites. And the degree of care and sophistication that's evident in this architectural construction is extraordinarily impressive and seems to be a particularly Inca characteristic. Now, Machu Picchu, I've noted the site, and it's certainly the most famous Inca site, still a grand tourist attraction in the Andes. Well, we have to note, however, that Machu Picchu is also quite uncharacteristic of Inca population centers. Entirely uncharacteristic. It probably had multiple functions. It served as a royal retreat, perhaps in both senses, because it also seems to have had a great deal of potential as a defensive position. So both as a place for Inca rulers and nobility to retreat from the hustle and bustle of Cusco, but also as a sort of a fortification, a royal fortification for the ruling group. It was also the location of considerable ceremonial activity. It's built on the heights of the Andes at an altitude of about 2,500 meters or 8,100 feet, overlooking the Urubamba Valley, about 80 kilometers or 50 miles northwest of Cusco. The site of Machu Picchu is an astonishing complex of elite residences, temples, plazas, fountains, and other structures built using dry stone architecture. The degree of water control, for example, on the site of Machu Picchu is extremely impressive. Machu Picchu was probably only occupied for about a century after construction began in AD 1460, and its permanent population, or at least its custodial population, we might say, was probably quite small. So as I said, it's not really comparable in any sense to a Inca urban center like Cusco. Those urban centers certainly did exist, but it's a fascinating archaeological site. The Inca developed an efficient infrastructure for governing their far-flung territories, including a complex bureaucracy and the famous Inca road system, which is one of the best-known characteristics of the Inca state, and really one that, in a sense, is more characteristic of the Inca than of many ancient states. These roads linked different parts of the empire, and in theory, their use was limited to military forces, government officials, and goods and people being moved on the order of the state. That is, they were not roads that were open to general economic or social activity by common people, except when ordered to be used by the ruling structures of the state. They were the most obvious elements in an elaborate communication system, one that also involved networks of rest and provisioning houses along the roads, and a specialized corps of messengers. So we think about the roads as the most permanent and, in a sense, striking element in this communication system, but in fact, there was a whole infrastructure for moving information and goods around the empire. As I've noted, these administrative advances on the part of the Inca were to some degree borrowed from earlier states in the area, but they do seem to have reached new levels of elaboration with the Inca. This also seems to have involved a good deal of standardization across the empire, with sumptuary laws that governed how people could display their status in dress and other material goods, as well as elaborate systems of social identification that were used as the basis of a census and tax collection system. Now, extraordinarily enough, the Inca did all this without ever developing writing. It seems from a variety of cases that we've already seen, Teotihuacan springs to mind, for example, that very large and complex states can indeed be run successfully without recourse to a writing system, although probably not without some form of account keeping. So instead of writing, the Inca used a record-keeping system based on knotted string, or quipu. A quipu consists of a tied-together collection of fibers of different lengths and sometimes different material, with knots of different types positioned at different points along these fibers. There's been a good deal of analysis and debate about how these quipu might be read, because the form of reading them has not really survived. and very few of the quipu themselves survive. But it now appears that the quipu are primarily a numerical system used for keeping accounts, for taxation purposes, and for purposes of keeping calendars. The quipu also seem to have been used in making arithmetical calculations, but it's not clear how that actually worked. Recent research has demonstrated that at least a few of the knots on quipu probably had non-numeric values, instead serving as identifiers for places, towns, or political districts, for example. And that's moving towards something more like a symbol system that looks a little more like writing, but of course, quipu are nothing like writing. The usefulness of such place name identifiers in bureaucratic administration would be obvious. The Inca economic system seems to have had two quite distinct elements. First, local, kin, and community-based economic production and exchange of ceramics and textiles, for example, in local styles and for local use. And second, much larger scale production that was heavily centralized and standardized and controlled by the state. This latter involved agriculture and the mass production of ceramics, textiles, metal objects, and a variety of other kinds of materials. If we synthesize all of this material, to some degree the Inca economy seems to resemble that of Egypt thousands of years before, without the development, for example, of a widespread market system. It's notable that in Bruce Trigger's dichotomy of city and territorial states, this dichotomy that I've frequently referred to in these lectures, both the Egyptian and the Inca state are model examples of the latter of territorial states. The Inca state had an elaborate bureaucratic hierarchy, and urban centers were relatively unimportant beyond Cusco. It could hardly be said, however, that local populations existed less disturbed by the Inca center, which is supposed to be one characteristic of territorial states, may have been true of the Egyptian state, but certainly it appears that the Inca were fairly interventionist in their relationships with populations throughout the state. Population densities were probably on the whole lower than around, say, the city-states in the Maya heartland. In many ways, the Inca state is a more striking case of territorial state expansion than was the Egyptian example. It covered an area far larger than any state we'd examined to this point, and it forcibly incorporated a multitude of different ethnic and cultural groups. However, it's also worth remembering that the Inca had a long cultural and ideological tradition of state formation and governance to draw upon, unavailable to the pharaohs. In addition, this period of initial Inca expansion only lasted about a century and was still ongoing when the Spaniards arrived. Would have been interesting to know how this would have played out. One of characteristic of territorial states is that they're prone to breakup and reversion to more local control. And we can speculate about how long the Inca expansion could have been kept up, especially given the instability provided by the system of royal succession. In any case, the Inca state ultimately fell to the Spaniards in AD 1532. By this point, many areas of the globe were feeling the effects of European expansion, and so it becomes difficult to examine state formation processes without reference to that European expansion. For that reason, our survey of the origins of ancient states and civilizations is now coming to an end. For my next lecture, I'll try and bring together some of the themes that I believe can be demonstrated in the cases that we've looked at through this series of lectures. Thank you.